All right, we're going to be continuing to move on now in our study in the book of Acts. Obviously, the message of God, the key component is the resurrected. That's the thing that just keeps coming up over and over again. It's the sort of, Charles Spurgeon had said one time that whatever he teaches, whatever he's doing, he makes a beeline right for the cross. For Paul, it was the resurrection. Regardless of what Paul was doing, he always tied it back to the resurrection. Remember, even there on Athens, back in chapter 17, he had the philosophers. They were interested in what he had to say. They couldn't argue with his reasoning, with his logic. I mean, how are you going to argue with his truth? It's as simple as that. And they were willing to listen, and they were willing to move the direction that he was saying and explaining who this unknown God was. And we know from the past that whole thing with that altar that was there. We took the time to look at all of that. But as he moves forward through the message, then what ends up happening, everybody's willing to listen to him until he comes to, of course, the resurrection. And at that point, they just go, yeah, here's another babbler, and off he goes. But there were those that understood the significance. So the resurrection, the theme of the resurrection throughout the book of Acts is very, very significant, because it's the one thing that separated then, as it does now, Christianity from all other religions. It is the resurrection. It's not Christmas. It's not Easter. Well, it is Easter, I guess, because it's about the resurrection. It's just, that's what it is. That was the verification that Jesus was who he claimed to be. So as we've been moving through, we'd look at Paul's first missionary journey, remember, which primarily was focused in what they called Asia Minor, what we know today as Turkey. Then the second missionary journey, after having returned to Syriac and Antioch in Syria, then he went back out again. And this was the time, remember, he had prayed to go into the area where he finds himself now on his third missionary journey. But the Lord wouldn't let him at that point. It was not the time. In fact, God wanted the gospel up in Europe. And so on that second missionary journey, Paul went up into Europe, and the gospel for the first time in its history entered in and through Europe. And there were churches that were established there, Thessalonica, Berea, Corinth, blah, blah, blah. You get the whole thing, and all of this incredible stuff is going on. Paul has returned now on the third missionary journey. He's gone back through Asia Minor, once again through Turkey, kind of along the Mediterranean Sea, and he's gone all the way. Then he went south, and he went to this place called Ephesus. And that's where we find him now. And we've seen what's going on in Ephesus. The synagogue there was very receptive to the gospel, as they had been in Berea. And things were going really well, and the ministry was there, and Paul had promised them that he would come back. Remember, they listened to him that first Sabbath, and they said, man, we want you to hang out and tell us some more. Paul says, no, I can't. I got to go back to Jerusalem. The whole vow thing, remember? And now he's back in Ephesus, and that's what we looked at. We're going to see here this morning and even on into next week that he spent about 3 years there. This is, as far as we know, was the longest period of time where he ever spent ministering. But his MO was the same as it's always been. He went into the synagogues and teached and taught. And we saw last week where it was going well, until finally the Jews said, we've had enough of this. We're not going to listen to this anymore. And so then he departed and he went to this school of Tyrannus, remember? And this sort of meeting hall thing. And that's where they've been meeting and doing the studies. And so this is where it's going. So opposition is starting to rise now, but nothing in the sense that what we're going to see today, because we're going to be talking about this riot that occurred during the days of Paul towards the end of his stay in Ephesus. And we're going to see how that plays into today, because there are some great lessons to learn. So when we come to the 21st chapter of our 21st verse of chapter 19, this is where the story picks up from where we left off last week. Now, last week, remember, after all of these things had taken place, we were told, Luke wrote for us in the 20th verse, that the gospel had taken root. This is obviously paraphrased, but that's what he meant. The gospel had taken root, and Christians were coming by the droves. People, they were sick of the garbage of worshiping these false gods and these idols, who would never do anything for the people except demand, demand, demand. All right, we're going to see how that's going to tie into today. But when we left off in verse 20, the gospel was expanding, and the church was growing, and it was being strengthened. Paul had done what he wanted to do when he had gotten to Ephesus. So with that in mind, we come to verse 21, and you can see here. So when these things were accomplished, that is, when Paul had gotten to that place where the ministry was starting to take root on its own, and he could sort of pull out of ministry, which is the key to ministry, to train up others, right? So you can get the crud out of the way, and if God moves you on, you can go. And that's what we're going to see is happening here. So that's what the things that were accomplished. When these things were accomplished, literally it's finished, or they had been fulfilled, Paul purposed in the Spirit, when he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia, to go to Jerusalem, saying, after I've been there, I must also see Rome. So he sent into Macedonia two of those who ministered to him, Timothy and Erastus, but he himself stayed in Asia. Anytime you see that Asia, it's talking about Asia Minor, but in particular Ephesus, because that was the key city in that region. Again, today for us, Turkey. So he left Timothy and sent Timothy and Erastus, but he himself stayed in Asia for a long time. So Paul knows he's coming to the end of his ministry now in Ephesus. He has returned, which he told the synagogue he was going to do. The gospel was doing what only the gospel can do, and it was permeating not only the city of Ephesus, but the surrounding communities. It was really spreading all through Asia Minor. And so Paul had a sense in his heart that his time or for ministry there was becoming fulfilled, and it was going to be time for him to move on. Now, he had only been in Europe one time. Remember, we talked about that. But he always went back through the churches and reestablished and strengthened them, and he instructed them and he encouraged them, and he would appoint leaders and all that. So this is probably why he wants to go on into Europe again, because that's what it's talking about. And he purposed in his spirit, or in the spirit. So it appears that it doesn't specifically mean that the spirit said to Paul, it's time to move, but the spirit moved on Paul to say that it was time to move. Okay, that's what's taking place. In other words, Paul knew, as we've already said, that he was coming to the end of his ministry there. So when he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia to go to Jerusalem, so his intentions were to conclude his ministry there in Ephesus, to go on across over the Aegean Sea, on over there into Europe one more time to these churches. And Achaia, remember, that's where Corinth is at. And he was going to go over there. And he wanted to do a bunch of stuff there. This is around Pentecost, when the time frame that we're talking about. He wants to get over there and get some ministry stuff done. And then he wants to get to Jerusalem for the Passover. This is sort of the time frame that's taken place here. Now, we're not told here in the book of Acts, but we are told in Romans and 1 Corinthians and a couple other places why Paul is so intent on getting back over into these areas, besides the ones we've already talked about, strengthening and encouraging the brethren. The church in Jerusalem was now suffering. There was a famine going on, and the people were having a rough time of it. And so Paul had communicated this to the churches, and they had taken up offerings that they were going to send along with somebody from the Gentile churches in Europe, and probably through Asia Minor as well. And they were going to take up a collection for the believers in Jerusalem. And that's what Paul is doing here. He's going there and he's going to collect these things, as well as the other things that we talked about. He's going to collect these things, and then his intention is to go back to Jerusalem. But then he says, once that is completed, and of course trying to be back there by Passover, once that is completed, then what he wants to do, I must also see Rome. Paul's heart was for ministry. He didn't want to see Rome like we do today, to take a bunch of photographs and stand in front of the Roman Colosseum and stuff in all of its, you know, glory of the day or whatever. He wanted to go there because he knew it was becoming the center. We talked about last week how he had shifted from Syria in Antioch in Syria. Good grief, I got to get those right. From Antioch in Syria and Jerusalem, and the ministry was shifting now to Ephesus and then to Rome. And from this point on in the book of Acts, Rome is going to become the focus. And the reasons are obvious. Rome was where it all was at. It was the hub, so to speak, of everything that went out, because the Romans had made sure that that was the case. Now, their intentions certainly were different. But in Paul's mind, Rome was where the place, if you could get in there and you could get the gospel, and it already was there. There was a pretty thriving church even by this time, that Paul wanted to go in there and he wanted to minister to them. And then we're told in the book of Romans, and I think it's 1 Corinthians, that he also wanted to go beyond Rome and going over into Spain. So he wanted to get the gospel out there. That's why he wanted to go to Rome. And I'm sure we learned from the book of Romans that in the first chapter that his desire was to go there and to impart knowledge to them, but the Spirit had, by to this juncture, had not said, not allowed him to do so. And so he was kind of frustrated by that. He is going to end up going to Rome, but it's not going to be a journey that he's going to enjoy. But it's going to be a journey of ministry as well. So it was just amazing the way that God would work this thing out. We always have these wonderful plans of the things that we're going to do for God, don't we? But the idea of being taken prisoner and shipwrecked and landing on an island, getting bit by a dang snake, really seem to be part of it. We'd like to fly there in the jumbo jet, get served all of the food on the flight. Very important for me when I make these flights. And get served and then land and get everything established, get rested up, get showered up, change the clothes, and get out there and stuff. You know, this is how we envision getting ministry. Yeah, the trip's hard, But if we knew that what waited us to get out there and to do the ministry like Paul's heart was for that, would we, if Paul had known that he was going to make this journey and been shipwrecked and bitten by a snake and all of this other stuff, it makes you wonder whether he would have went. Now, there's no doubt that Paul would have gone. And many of us would have gone as well. But the reality of it is, sometimes when God calls us, it doesn't quite go the way that we would like for it to go. But it's still part of his plan and still part of his purpose. We've got this idea that everything has to be systematic and chronological. And as long as it moves forward and like this, this is God's indication that we're where he wants us to be. But it isn't always that case. We're always going to be where he wants us to be because he's God. Hello? But the point is that it doesn't always go. And so Paul would exactly get his wish. So we're at the end of this time now in Ephesus, and all these things are going good, and so Paul's going to go, listen, I'm going to head out, but before I do, he sends Timothy. We already know about Timothy, right? He sends him and this fellow Erastus, and he says, you guys go on over to Corinth and get all of the stuff settled there so that when I get there, we can deal with this, and then I can get back to Jerusalem. That's basically what's happening, okay? That's what's taking place here. But about that time, there arose a great commotion about the way. This is Luke's word for Christianity. That's what he would call it. He called it the way. And it was all about the fact that the way, you know, proclaimed the gospel, the Lord Jesus Christ, and of course, and him resurrected, as we've already talked about. But at the end of this, or coming towards the end of this 3-year period, things begin to get a bit into an uproar here. Because what's happening is Christianity is growing, for those that are not becoming Christians, at an alarming rate in the city of Ephesus. The city of Ephesus, and we're going to see this here in a few minutes, had this incredible temple, I'm not going to spend time on it now, dedicated to this particular goddess, and it was huge. And it was the goddess Artemis. We see it as Diana, but we'll talk about that in a minute. It was so important to the city of Ephesus that they added an extra month on every year that was called Artemision. And it was the month that was dedicated for people to come and to worship Artemis or Diana at her specific temple. And so what they had is they had a sort of a union, a labor union, if you will, sort of a guild of all sorts of craftsmen that made all these little trinkets for not only the temple, but for the goddess herself. Some of them even had the trinket was the temple with Diana in the middle. So you could kind of look in there, and they didn't even have 3D printing in those days. But anyway, but that's what we're talking about here. And so what's happening is, boy, every other year, all of these crowds would come for all over, you know, to worship. Oh, great is Diana of Ephesians. And, you know, everybody would come. And so these guys would stand out on the street. And for those that could afford, they would buy the silver, right? I mean, that's what you did if you had the money to do so. Because then when you weren't there, you could set it up on your little thing and you could bow to it, you know, the whole kind of thing and be blessed by, even though you weren't in her presence, you get the idea, right? But not only but everybody could afford the silver. So there were guys that also made these things out of clay. There were guys that made them out of wood. Obviously not quite as fancy as the silver ones were. But that's what's going on here. Well, all of a sudden, they're out there selling their wares every other year. But this Christian thing is really starting to irritate them. Because all of a sudden, nobody's interested in buying their little trinkets anymore. I mean, profits have dropped 40, 50, 60%. We don't know what they are, right? And I mean, these guys are going, what the crud, man? I used to make a major league living doing this stuff. Diana been very, very good to me. Most of you don't get that. But anyway, Roberto Clemente, right, Jeff? Yeah, baseball been very, very good to me. Yeah, anyways, but this, in this case, it's Diana. But you get the idea. So all of a sudden, this stuff isn't selling because most of the city, I don't know about most, but many in the city have become a believer. So nobody's buying these things. Nobody's interested anymore in Diana nor in her temple. Oh, it's a nice looking building, but they're not interested in this. Well, all of a sudden, you've got one loudmouth guy, and that's all it takes, named Demetrius to get everything into an uproar. And that's what we're talking about. So there were, about that time, there arose this great commotion about the way. So Timothy and Erastus have gone. Paul's about to head out. And this is what's happening. For whatever reason, he doesn't appear to be in the scene at this juncture. We're going to see why here in just a few minutes. But this is what's the sort of the setting for what's happening. For there a certain man named Demetrius, who was a silversmith, who made silver shrines of Diana, brought no small profit to the craftsmen. So this guy appears to have been sort of the head dude of all of the craftsmen guilds, whether wood, clay, whatever. Silver, obviously. Okay, there's even a possibility of some bronze. We'll talk about that here in a second, too. But this guy, he made a, basically we would say this guy made serious money by selling these things. That's what's happening. His name is Demetrius. And so in verse 25, he called them together with the workers of similar occupation. That's the guys that worked in clay as well as the guys that worked in wood with the guys in silver. That's what's going on here. Okay. And then he said, men, you know that we have our prosperity by this trade. So here's a true worshiper. Right? He's all about Diana and her temple. Yeah, he's really all about that. No, he's not about that at all. He's about making money on people that really thought that this goddess could do something for her. That's what this is all about. The guy's heart is on his sleeve right here. It's clear that he has no interest in Diana or the people that worship Diana, but only in the profit that can be made in showing these things off and selling these things for Diana. This was about him and these people. Look at this. You know that we have our prosperity by this trade. We are dependent on whether or not our things sell. It's really stunning because for us, we don't realize what this is like. But trust me, when you're in a place like Kathmandu in Nepal and you walk the stairs up to that temple and you see all of that stuff, like I've told you guys before, on those steps, and they're selling all of this stuff. There's this God, there's that God, there's these things, there's the prayer wheels and all that stuff. That's all the stuff I told you is in the office, and that's why I brought back so you could see it. It's just, it doesn't make sense to us that people could actually be bound up in this stuff. That they could actually go to a temple and walk around and spin these wheels, and every time the wheel went around, they were sending up so many prayers. And so they just walked around the thing, just spinning this thing, so they get their, 10,000 prayers in for the day, and everything was hunky-dory with the gods. I mean, it's pretty pathetic. But, so we're not talking about something that's 2,000 years old here. We're talking about something that's happening today in certain places of the world. This is exactly what's happening. Nothing has changed. Now, most of these people are not getting rich off of selling this stuff, obviously, because most of the people that come by their little, their little shops, for lack of a better term, obviously don't have much money to purchase these things. So what they're doing is waiting for the big fat white American to come through there and be a dork and say, oh, I'll take one of those. That's what they do. But this is how they survive on these things. So, I mean, though we certainly don't condone the concept of idolatry and images and things like that, it is understandable why these people would do this. Because, you see, you keep people hooked to their religion when you sell all the little trinkets and stuff. I mean, that's the whole point. To this day, people do that. We even see it in America, just not at the extent that we're talking about here. But this guy has recognized there's a problem, and so he calls everybody together, and he's saying, listen, we're going to have to do something here. Because the very prosperity, our profit is at stake. This isn't about Diana. It's not about her temple. It's about us and the money flowing rapidly out of our pockets. See, he's concerned about this. Now, we know that about 50 years after this, this fellow by the name of Pliny would write to Trajan. And he would say, writing from Ephesus, that talking about the Christians, and as he was there, just 50 years after this, and he would basically say, nobody comes to this temple anymore, and there isn't anyone to buy all the trinkets. I mean, this is historical. So even though this guy appears to be quite a flake, he was right on the money. You see, the gospel had taken root. And when light comes in, it always dispels the darkness. Always. Truth always exposes the error, always, without fail. And that's what was happening. Now, it doesn't mean everybody was coming into this. It just means that the gospel was doing what the gospel always does. And when it comes in and truth is proclaimed, everything else is shown for what it is. And that, of course, is error. And that's what was taking place here. Moreover, Demetrius continues, you see and hear that not only at Ephesus, but throughout almost all Asia, that he's talking about all of what we again know as Turkey. Folks, that's a huge area. He's saying, look, what this guy is doing and what these Christians are doing, obviously Paul was recognized as the instigator, so to speak. This guy has not only done this here, but this is spreading all through Asia Minor. Makes you wonder if he knew about Phrygia and all of the other places as well, but whatever. But throughout almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away many people. Boy, how would you like to have that moniker attached to your name? Think about that. that the Lord used me to turn over an entire province of Rome. Yes. To the point to where people are starting to really say, this gospel thing is really something. I mean, it's pretty staggering. But I mean, what an amazing title to be wearing. This Paul guy, he spread this gospel all over the place. Wow, I wish they could say that about me. Holy cow. But I guess we're talking about holy cow. We're back to the idol thing, aren't we? It just slipped out, sorry. But anyway, so in all of Asia, this Paul had persuaded and he turned away many people. He turned them away from all of this nonsense. Now we see this repeatedly time and time again. It's starting with Cornelius. And we've seen all of this stuff and all of this junk about the worship of the Greek gods or the Roman gods. We're going to see here that this particular goddess is different than the Greek goddess by the same name. These people couldn't even get on the same page. And so all of this stuff is going on. But if you lived in that day, as I've already said, you've given everything to these so-called gods. You give your money, you give your food. To this day, again, when you're in these cultures and third world and stuff like this, people that have nothing, they have no food, they'll take it and they'll lay this stuff at these symbols of their gods or their temples or whatever. It is pathetic. It's nauseating. And you just think, how can people not understand? So this is the way that it was and it is the way that it is. But it had taken such root, it was just amazing. And we saw this, and people would finally get to the point and they're saying, man, this is ridiculous. This cannot be the way that it's supposed to be. I keep doing everything for this God and for that God and for this God. I get nothing in return because the gods will always leave you empty because there is no gods. Isaiah, I love Isaiah 40. We talked about this a few weeks ago where God is saying, well, go ahead and get your idols and so we can have a talk. Go ahead and build them out of stone. The guy that's got the money, he's got, you know, he does this. He has this thing carved and he covers it in gold and then he makes silver chains to hold it so that it doesn't fall over. The people that can't afford the gold, well, they have them made out of wood. God says, go ahead and bring them guys up. Let's head down and we'll have a talk. Let's see if they can tell us about the things that have been, things that aren't, things that'll be. I love that. There was no such thing as these gods. It's what people make them out to be. There is one God. End of story. And whether people like it or not is irrelevant. Whether they accept it or not is irrelevant. It just doesn't matter. Truth, as we've already said, is simply that. Truth. But that's what these people were doing. So this, well, Paul, he's flipped this whole dang place up on its ear and saying that they are not gods which are made with hands. Why? Well, apparently he had listened to Paul because that's exactly what was saying. How can something, this is what he told the Athenians, God is not worshipped by something that's made with your hands. If he is God, do you really think he needs you to form and fashion it? I mean, common sense has got to enter the picture at some point here. And that's what he's saying. This is what they're saying. But we know that he didn't go after them. He just simply stated the truth. Verse 27. So not only is this trade of ours in danger of falling into disrepute. Funny, now it's a trade. You see? You see the subtle change that has just taken place? This guy is a typical union boss. It isn't about the people. It isn't about anything. It's about what can line the pockets. That's his heart's desire. Oh, and whether or not he realized that he just stuck his tongue out and probably stepped on it or not, look at the rest of this. But also, not only is our trade and our funds at stake, oh, but also the temple of the great goddess Diana may be despised. As if you care. See? Boy, I better throw Diana in here, otherwise they're going to think I'm just talking about money. Well, we already got that. Sorry. So, but also the temple of the great goddess Diana made to be despised and her magnificence destroyed. You know the magnificence that you guys create on your wood and your clay and your silver? That magnificence? That's the one, you know. And her magnificence destroyed. And whom all Asia and the world worship. Well, that's a bogus statement. All of Asia didn't, which is why you're having the conversation, Demetrius. So all of Asia isn't worshiping Diana. You wouldn't have the problem you have there, doofus. But also all in the world worship him. Now, if you know anything about those days and the people that worship them, well, even today, these were very localized gods. Okay, in other words, the God, wherever the temple was at, typically the primary blessing, of course, was for those that were in that area because the temple or whatever worship center had been set up for these people was there. And so it was this huge thing. But and typically people that were around, well, they knew, you know, who your God was and what representation your God was, but they didn't worship yours. And the reason, because they had their own. There's temples all over there. You ever looked at archaeology and what they found going through all of this region and stuff like that? They find temples to this stuff. And we think, man, what a bunch of goofy people. Well, there are people today, folks, that worship rocks and hug trees and wear, you know, the pyramid and there's, you know, there's power in the stones. I mean, give me a break. But there's people that still do this. It's just, it is heartbreaking is what it is. It is, how do you get a hold of something like this? You see, in the heart of man, there's always something bigger than man. Did you ever notice that? There always is, always. It could be a stone, it could be anything. Of course, we know the truth, but that's what's going on out there. So our trade's not only in danger, but oh, so is Diana. She's worshipped around the world. Well, that's not a true statement, dude. She's not worshipped all over the world. People will come here and see the magnificent temple. And by the way, the temple of Diana at Ephesus was one of the seven wonders of the world. That's what it looked like in Paul's day. That's an artist's rendition, obviously. I don't think he was there to sketch this, but you get the idea. This thing was magnificent. It was one of the seven wonders of the world. You don't get to be one of the seven wonders of the world unless the thing is dang nice. Okay? You just don't. Taj Mahal, of course, was another one. But this thing was just amazing, and this is what it looked like in all of the pillars and stuff. Okay? If you go there today, you've probably taken pictures. There's what it looks like today. Again, Demetrius was correct. About 200 years after this event, it would be destroyed, it would be burned, and I mean, we could just go, the Goths came in there and, you know, did all kinds of weird stuff, but we won't get into all that. But you see that center, that's the problem with all of these things. You have your central or localized god or goddess that you worship, and you build this temple, but nobody else cares about. Well, if Demetrius was right and the whole world worshiped Diana, then why was the temple destroyed? And by the way, that temple that we just saw, the artist's rendition of, that was like the third or, I can't remember if it was the third or the fourth time it had to be built because it had been destroyed before several times. So much for the world worshiping Diana. But anyway, that was the point. Now when they, that is the workers' guild, the folks in the union, now when they heard this, they were full of wrath and cried out saying, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." Boy, it doesn't take much to get a mob going, does it? Doesn't take much at all, especially if it's something against you, you know, something against that you believe. You get somebody else to believe it and people that are surrounded, and then you start walking around your picket signs. You get the idea. And it just continues to go on. But I want you to notice something here. Great is Diana, notice, of the Ephesians, okay? Because the Romans and the Greeks also worshipped the Diana. This Diana, as we're going to see, supposedly fell from heaven, okay? Probably a meteorite. Initially, you know, people will worship anything. It came out of the sky. Should God threw it down? Like the gods must be crazy, right? Throwing that Coke bottle out the airplane when it's that dude did that whole thing just causes a whole ruckus. If you've never seen that, you got to see it. I'm telling you, it is absolutely hilarious. But you got to be able to speak. If you watch the program, you'll know what I'm talking about. But great is Diana of the Ephesians. Different than the Diana of the Greeks. Diana of the Greeks was the daughter of Jupiter / Zeus and the twin brother of Apollos. Okay? You've seen the statues of her. She was worshipped by the Greeks as the goddess or the huntress, they called her. She's the one with the statue. You may have seen it where she's, you know, she's all statued and she's got the bow and all of this stuff. That's her. I always wondered, how do you get a god to stand still long enough to chisel out a thing that looks like her? Must be a patient god, right? But anyway, but that's what they did. And that was the Greek version of her. But as her place in the heavens, because of course she was on earth, there's always a connection between heaven and earth, these demigods, right? You get the whole thing, which was Achilles' problem. But anyway, you get this whole thing that's going on between what's going on here. But when she was in the heavens, she was the goddess of the moon. Luna, they called her at some time. So she was the goddess of the moon. But this Diana, or Artemis, is different. This is one that supposedly Jupiter, I don't know if he tossed her out of heaven or what the case may be, but she fell to earth. And apparently, whatever the thing was, you know, we're talking, you know, BC, a few hundred years BC probably, when they looked at this meteor, somehow they saw this female with like, you know, 50 breasts. It's hard for me to imagine, but something, because she was the goddess of fertility, everybody, you know, she was the great mother and all of this stuff. And that's what, if you've ever looked Diana of the Ephesians up, there's this grotesque looking thing. So apparently they saw a meteor and this is what came to mind. I'm just saying. So that's what they came up with, and that's what this is all about. Great is Diana of the Ephesians. To be separate of the Ephesians means she was not to be identified with the Diana of the Greeks. Okay? That's what it was. Verse 29. So the whole city was filled with confusion. The whole city now. This is spread from wherever they met for this initial meeting, and it's permeated through the city. And everybody's walking in the city, many of which are now Christians, and they're hearing this great uproar, and everybody's going, what the heck is going on here? What's happening? And that's what's being described. So the whole city was filled with confusion, and they rushed into the theater, that thing that we just saw. And they rushed in, I'm not sorry, that wasn't the theater, that was the temple. And they rushed into the theater with one accord, and on the way they seized Gaius and Aristarchus. They were both Macedonians, and they were Paul's traveling companions. So for whatever reason, Paul does not seem to be there at this point. Once again, we don't know why. We can speculate all we want. The reality of it is, whatever, these people that were going to do this thing, that rushed into the theater, they saw, those are two of his guys. And they grabbed them and they pulled them along with them. Gaius, we believe, was from over there in Corinth. And it was probably, as we read some of Paul's other writings, there's some little things mentioned about him. It appears he was like a secretary or a treasurer, maybe is probably a better way to put it, and handled some money, which would make sense because he would be sent with Timothy, or you know, he would be handling the money, which was the money going to Jerusalem, right? Even though Aristarchus was, I forgot the other guy's name already. But anyway, you get the idea. Gaius and Aristarchus, they were Macedonians. They're Paul's traveling companions. So they seize these guys. And they take them up before the mob. And everybody's going nuts now. And everybody's going, what is happening here? What's going on? Because you see, if you were a Roman province, it meant you were trusted to sort of run things yourself. There was a proconsul there, but you basically were given the freedom to do this. But what Rome would not tolerate in any way, shape, or form was a riot. Because Rome always saw it as a threat to its empire. They always took it as a political thing. And so the minute the Roman Empire would understand that there was an uproar like this, they really didn't care the reason. They would make it political. They would send in the troops, and we all know what that would lead to, right? Things were going to get real ugly real fast. And that's what's taking place here. So they take these guys and they throw them up there. Paul is seeing this. Now, Paul is not one to shy away from people who threaten him or his friends. We've seen that. If Paul was anything else, and he was a lot of things, he was a brave dude. I mean, he was able to handle it. Now, whatever the case may be, this was so hard on Paul that he would later write that he even was even concerned for his life here. It was bothering him that he couldn't do anything. And the reason he couldn't do anything, we'll see. And when Paul wanted to go into the people, the disciples would not allow him. No. What are you, nuts? You're not going to help a thing by going in there, Paul. And you're probably going to get yourself killed. It makes no sense for you to enter into the fray. It just doesn't. They've already got Gaius and Aristarchus. There's no point in putting your head on a chopping block. It's foolish for you to do so. Now, if you were Paul and your brothers were taken into custody and the worst is on your mind, it's going to kill you to be held and not be able to go in there. And that's what Paul seems to be describing when he writes the letter to the Corinthians. We don't know for sure, but that's what it seems. He would even say, I want to say it was to Timothy that Paul would write that he dealt with beasts in Ephesus. And now commentators have all been, oh, what did they mean? They put him in there to fight the lions, tigers, and bears, oh my. No. Paul was saying these probably meant these people were acting like wild animals when he made that statement, but whatever. But look at verse 31. Then some of the officials of Asia, these are called actually Asiarchs, and what they were is they were top dudes, kind of like, I would say, probably equivalent to mayors of all of the different cities. And they were the ones that were in control of the of all of the stuff that happened during the year. And in particular, like when they had the gladiator stuff and there was the big, you know, athletic events that went on. These were the guys that controlled that. Now, what's interesting, then some of the officials of Asia who were his friends, Paul's friends, does not say brethren. So it's believed that these guys, that Paul had had a great influence on these guys, and they kind of liked him. But they hadn't become believers. But they're people with some means. You see, that tells us the kind of ministry that Paul had and the kind of ministry that we should strive for. We always have this idea that we've got to go into these places like we've been describing, overseas and whatever. And we've got to go in there with guns a-blazing and we've just got to shoot down all the all of their idol worship. And we just to call it, let's just call a spade a spade. I mean, these people are in gross sin and they're before God and blah, blah, blah. If you do that, they'll never hear a word you say. That's never what Jesus did. Certainly doesn't appear to be what Paul's. And there's no indication these guys are believers, but they like him. There's a relationship between them. They probably respected him. Because unlike maybe others that came in, possibly even the Jews earlier on, Paul isn't going in there and trashing their religion. You don't have to do that. You don't have to live in a place like Mesquite and point out the fallacy of some of the teaching that's around. There's no point in it. You'll accomplish nothing except to get people to not listen to you. What you do is you proclaim the truth. Because what did we say earlier? Truth will always expose error. Always. Truth does not need you and I to defend it. It's truth. If it needed a defense from any of us, it wouldn't be the truth, would it? But it is the truth. And of course, the truth is light. It's light. It brings illumination. Reality sets in. And if we just do those things, just teach the truth and let people be illuminated by the truth itself, it's amazing what will change. We don't have to stand on some quote-unquote cult's doorstep or trash them. We just don't have to. It's not necessary. All we have to do is proclaim truth. It's that simple because the truth can't be argued with, even from our perspective, right? So the whole city was thrown into this. So the friends of Paul now, they sent to him. And notice they're pleading that he would not venture into the theater. Paul, trust us as your friends. People that respect you. Don't do this. If you enter into the fray, this thing that's already out of hand is going to completely spin out of control. And there will be no bringing it back. Don't even think about going in there. Now, Paul appears to have listened. Some therefore cried one thing and some another, for the assembly was confused. You think? That's the problem with the mob. There's absolute confusion. And if you sit down and you talk or interview, as we would say today, any of the people that are involved in this, 90% of them couldn't tell you why they were there yelling what they're yelling. They have no idea. It just seemed like the cool thing to do. Well, I was just at McDonald's having a burger and all these people came around. I thought I'd come out and see what's going on. So then why are you yelling what they're yelling? Well, it seems like the appropriate thing to do. Well, do you really believe what you're saying? Well, what does it matter? Everybody else seems to believe it. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we get. The mob mentality. The problem with the mob is it's a coward. It really is. That's the reason you need a mob. Because nobody within that mob has the courage to stand up on their own. You got to get the mob going. You got to get them on your side, or at least cause them to think they're on your side. Because you know dang well they don't understand. But if you can get a big enough crowd, it looks really impressive. But the reality is, if you strip all of that stuff away, the situation that's at the front of this thing and the people that are leading this thing are all cowards. Or they would have done it differently without a mob mentality behind them. So some cried one thing and some for another, for the assembly was confused. Now this is interesting because assembly is ecclesia, the word for church. That's what it is. Ek means to throw out or throw out of, and kaleo, which is the basis for the root, ekkaleo, ekklesia, means to throw an assembly together, which would later become known as the church. The church is thrown together by the work of the Lord. It's the same word. It's interesting how this is switching, because this confused assembly is in complete contrast to the believers and what has been going on in the city. Because there's been no hostility, there's been no ridicule, there's been no criticism, there's been none of these other things that can be pointed. We're going to see that in a few minutes. But this crowd is completely out of control. Most of them did not know why they had come together. That's what people should pass out as t-shirts at these things. I have no idea why I'm here, but I'm here. Right? Throwing my support behind so-and-so. And they drew Alexander out of the multitude, the Jews putting him forward. And Alexander motioned with his hand and he wanted to make his defense of the people. So what's happened here? There were obviously Jews in the city. And what was happening is the Jews said, "Now wait a second, you Ephesian nutcases. We don't want you guys to confuse us with these Christians. Okay? Your problem is with them. We've been great citizens, our little synagogues, and all of the stuff we're doing over here. We've never caused an uproar. This isn't from us." And for whatever reason, they choose this dude, Alexander, and they put him forth. Probably because he was a great speaker. Who knows? But he's got a name, Alexander, even though he's a Jew. Probably from Alexandria, right? So he's an eloquent guy. He's not from Jerusalem. He's a guy that obviously understood the Greek culture. So logically, if we're going to separate ourselves from these nutcase Christians, then what we got to do is we got to put somebody forward who can speak our cause. Now, there's a lot of debate over who this guy is. I'm not going to bore you with all of the details because there's a couple of other Alexanders that Paul writes to in both letters to Timothy. In 2 Timothy, he calls him a coppersmith, and he said, "He did me great harm." In 1 Timothy, Paul says that Aristarchus, along with this fellow named Philetus, were brethren, or at least looked as though they were brethren, and Paul had said, "But they're working for Satan, so I'm putting them outside of the church, so that Satan can have Adam." Okay? So whether this is the same guy or not, we simply don't know. Everybody argues over it. Who cares? Whatever, whether he was that guy that did Paul harm, he doesn't seem to be have very much power here. Because look at what happens in verse 34. "But when they," that's the crowd, "found out that he was a Jew, all with one voice cried out for about 2 hours. I've been at concerts that didn't rattle off people. Oh, you know. Of course, now I guess Prince is out there for a couple hours, right? But anyway, This is what's talking about. Can you imagine this massive crowd yelling out, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians, great is Diana." That would get real old in about 3 minutes. For 2 hours, Luke says. Now remember, Luke's a doctor. This guy has attention to detail. 2 hours this goes on. Man, if you didn't have a problem drinking when this thing started, you would have by the time it ended. This would have drove you nuts. And the roar was so great. Where are you going to escape this? Go home and shut the door? I mean, come on. This had to be, but what Luke is saying is this is how intense it was. For 2 hours, these people were yelling this statement. Most of them not understanding what they were saying. You think of another day where the crowds were incited. One day when Jesus rode on a donkey and entered the city. And they had just said before, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest." But it takes just the leaders. "Crucify him. Crucify him. Crucify him." And all of a sudden, there goes the crowd again. Unbelievable. Even Pilate said, "Okay. I'm washing my hands of this thing. The crowd is not going to be, you're not going to get the crowd to calm down, so let's just let it go." Sad. But that's what's happening. For 2 hours, they cried this out. It's staggering to even begin to think. So obviously, now this has reached the head dude of the city, or one of the head dudes. When the city clerk had quieted the crowd, so obviously he was there, and he knows, he's the city clerk. He's got attachments to Rome itself because he's in a position. He knows what's about to take place. And so he says, "Hey, wait a minute, you guys. Men of Ephesus, what man is there, as for the cry of great is Diana?" Is there really anybody that doesn't know the city of Ephesus is the temple of the guardian of the great goddess Diana? And here we find the part which most believe probably was a meteor. "And of the image which fell down from Zeus?" Come on, everybody knows that. This is nuts, you guys, saying this. It's pointless to keep chanting this over and over again when the whole world knows this. This is ridiculous. Therefore, since these things cannot be denied, we know what Ephesus is, we know about the temple, and we know about Diana. These things cannot be denied. You ought to be quiet and do nothing rashly. Where was this guy an hour and a half ago? I don't know, maybe he couldn't get through. I don't know. But I'm just thinking, why? He's, you know, obviously this thing is in a complete tizzy, and apparently whatever reason, now he speaks. For you have brought these men here. Oh, great, so you're shouting this when we know the whole world is, so it's ridiculous that you're shouting this. But then you've got these two guys here. For you have brought these men here who are neither robbers of temples nor blasphemers of your goddess. You brought these guys here on false charges. You have no point to what it is you're doing here. These guys are innocent. You may not like what they say. You may not agree with what they say. But of course, the politically correct view of this is, it doesn't matter, it hurts my feelings. And we that worship Diana, well, we want a safe space. Oh, it only happened 2,000 years ago. Really? Have you been paying attention to what's going on in academia, at the colleges across our land now? You can't say anything unless it's absolutely agreed in, because you might offend someone. I mean, this is... Oh yeah, these 2,000-year-old people, they were just nuts. You're not paying attention if you don't know this is happening now. Good grief. You've brought these men here who are neither robbers of temples. Had they robbed something from the temple, he's implying, had they done something for you to do this kind of thing, they would have been brought... They would suffer execution. Rome would not tolerate, and we'd have every right to do so. But not only did they rob anything from the temple, steal any of the money, they didn't even blaspheme your goddess. I love, did you catch that? Whose goddess? Your goddess. Now, does that mean that this town clerk, whoever he is separated himself from these guys? Is it possible? And there's no way to know this. I just found it interesting. But he's the town clerk of the city that just said, everybody knows who we are, but he separates them, your goddess. Has this guy become a believer? Wouldn't that be cool? Don't know. Whatever the case may be, he was obviously someone of some means. These guys are completely innocent. They haven't stolen anything, and they haven't blasphemed or talked trash about your goddess. So what is this? What I love about this is Demetrius never opens his mouth again throughout the whole thing here. We never hear from this guy. Because he had incited this thing on no grounds or no basis to be doing what he's doing. And whether we're told, whether we know or not, what happens is it makes you wonder what the crowd would say to Demetrius later on behind closed doors for doing something. Because what he has done here is put the whole city in peril. And that's the next place the city clerk takes it. Therefore, I've set my case now, Demetrius. Notice what he says. Therefore, if Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen, in case you forgot, there was a group that initiated this thing at Demetrius's beck and call. If they have a case against anyone, then the courts are open and there are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another. Isn't it stunning how far people will go to try to silence Christianity? Won't silence anyone else. Oh my gosh, we might offend them. But we don't care about those Christians. It's funny that we're the only ones that are doing that. I said this before. Why in all of the world, you don't see people out there going killing Hindus. You don't see them killing Muslims. Most Muslims are killing Muslims. But you don't see anybody hunting them down. You don't see any of this. Only the Christians. It's always been this way. But that's what Jesus told us. I don't know why we're so shocked by it. Right? They're going to hate you. They hated me. What part of that do we not understand? Right? They're just not going to get it. So if Demetrius has got a case, then let him bring the case. The offices are open. Here you guys are all here at the theater. Why weren't these men brought to these offices where the judges sit and judgment can be rendered? This is ridiculous. Now, if you're in the crowd, you're kind of going, well, I'm only here because he said I should come, right? It was her fault. I was following her, right? Never fails. Verse 39 now, but if you have any other inquiry to make, it shall be determined in the lawful assembly. In other words, use your head. If there's anything more to this, and we already know there isn't, but if there is anything more to this, then let's do it the right way, the legal way, so that we keep the boot of Rome off our heads. See, let's not press our luck. Verse 44, we are in danger of being called in question for today's uproar. You guys have already jeopardized every one of us for this absolute nonsense. That's what you've done. You're about to get us in huge amounts of trouble with the emperor and the incredible Roman army. Is this really worth it? We are in danger of being called in question for day's uproar, there being no reason which we may give to account for this disorderly gathering. So if Rome shows up, Demetrius, you're going to stand up there and you're going to point the finger at these guys for this nonsense? Because you got no case. And you know who will be held accountable for this? Not those guys. You will. Because you're the one that's incited this. And probably those guys, the craftsmen that are with you, they'll probably be held accountable too. You see, this is serious stuff. It's easy to pick on the Christians. You're not going to get retaliation. Again, I've always said this 100 times. It's amazing how the atheists will only pick on the Christians. They're cowards. They're just simply that. They're cowards. You never see them say anything against Muslims. Oh no, don't say anything about them. They'll speak about Christ and all of this kind of stuff. But boy, you think they'll talk about Muhammad? Are you insane? No. So you know what, coward man? Unless you're willing to jump the fence, we got nothing to talk about. Not interested in your opinion. These poor people feel sad for me. Your heart should be broken for this. It's so easy to pick on the Christians and how Christians treat women and ignore the rest of the world that also has their gods, which you say don't exist. But you single the Christians out because Christians are like Christ and you pray for your enemies and for those that spitefully use you. And you give water to them if they need water. And you give them their coat if they need it. Boy, you don't want to hear that. But they'll point out all of the other stuff while they ignore that. So it's easy to come after us because we will not retaliate. Wouldn't you like it if God would just allow us just once? Lord, I'm not asking to kill them. Just let me choke them till they pass out. That's all I ask. When their eyes go buggy and roll back in their head, I'll let go. I promise, Lord. I promise. There's no way, because Jesus would never do that. Never, ever, ever do that. So we have to not do that. Okay? There's no reason which we, I love it, he puts himself in this, politician, huh? We may give account for this disorderly gathering, putting himself with the people. Nothing wrong with that now, I'm just saying. But it's interesting how he does this. And when he had said these things, he dismissed the assembly. Obviously, his words rang true. Nobody had an argument, not even Demetrius. Makes you wonder about Gaius and Aristarchus, what they were thinking standing there. I mean, as far as they know, they're going to get drug out and, you know, whatever, flayed. They don't know what's going to happen. And all of a sudden, this dude comes in, settles down the situation. You got to think these guys were just going, but whatever it was, he got them to calm down. He challenged Demetrius. Yes. He pointed out the fallacy of the stuff that initiated this from the get-go. And then he dismissed the crowd. I love that. How did the crowd come together? Completely out of disarray, right? I mean, it was insane. Nobody knew what was going on. Nobody knew, you know, people were saying this, people were saying that. Nobody had a clue. This guy dismisses the assembly as if all of a sudden it's this organized situation. You see, all it takes is one person to stand up and to point out the truth. That's all it takes. Of course, in our day, you just change the channel, right? But that's what happens. See, that's all that happened. And all of a sudden, the assembly that was completely, now they're assembled as if they're turned loose, dismissed, as if they were some sort of legal gathering. So whoever this guy was, he was a silver-tongued devil. He had it made. I repeat, a politician. But it was really interesting to me how this absolute chaos, this guy calms it down and then treats it as if it was something that it never was from the beginning. This is an amazing individual. I hope he was a believer. Don't know. No way to know. We don't even know who he is. Well, whatever. He's a man not only of some means, he has the ability or the power, the authority, whatever you want to call it, to settle massive, clearly, disputes. But he was able to gain control and to sort of take the leadership role. This is somebody to be reckoned with here, whoever he is. And so he dismisses the crowd. So in our day, folks, again, nothing has changed. When we go to these places, you don't have to worry about going in there and pointing all of the wrong that these people believe. You just don't have to do that. It's not necessary. You just don't need to address it. You proclaim the truth. If there are people that have a problem in their worship of specific things, whatever they may be, rocks, trees, mermaids, whatever the case may be, there's no point in sitting there and arguing about these things. You take them to Genesis chapter 1. You see, because in Genesis chapter 1, it answers all of the questions. The rocks are nothing. They were spoken into existence. The trees were existed because there was this one God that did all this. There's a created order that can't be argued with. Therefore, there could not be a half man, half fish. That's what you do. You take them to the truth. You turn people's attention to the truth of God. That is the most effective way to evangelize. End of story. No matter where you go. It's just all that you have to do. Now you may have to learn to come at it from a little different angle simply because of cultural differences and blah, blah, blah. Yes, but it's still the truth. And the truth always, always exposes the lie. Now we need to stand up for the faith, but we don't need to defend it. It doesn't need us. We've only been around a very short time. Faith has survived a long time. And it will survive a long time even without our defense of it. So that shows you how significant we are to it. But we should live our lives in such a way as Paul did, so that even if we have friends in high places, that these people respect us enough, whether they believe us or not is irrelevant. They respect us enough to act on this. So that when certain things arise, hopefully not to this degree, that these people will get behind us. And say, wait a second here. I don't believe what Paul believed. But if you think this is something that Paul or Rick or Carol or whoever else, if you really think this is something that they would do, then you don't know these people. What a great testimony. You see, it's that type of ministry that changes things from where we are out. And it's this type of thing that ultimately, at some point, depending on where God puts us, people can actually say, well, you know, that one person really changed everything. Meh. There are so many, we could go back and point out all of those guys that went into these countries throughout the past, those that are still going out there, and the impact that they've had on these countries is still to this day established. It is stunning. And what they did is they pointed out the truth. That is the gospel. So as we stand this morning and close in prayer, that's the thing that I want you to take from this morning. It isn't the words flopping through our lips that are going to change anyone. It's important what we say, but it's more about who we are. The testimony that we have for Christ. So that, as we've said thousands of times in the past, when people look at us, they don't see us. They see our God. When they hear us, they don't hear us. They hear our God. That's how we need to be. Notice there's nothing about perfection in that statement. There's one person that's near perfection, and I can't bring her name up in there because I'm just kidding. We all know this. God's not worried about whether or not we're the perfect people. What he wants is us simply to love as he loved. And sometimes that means you love that which is unlovely. Amen? All right, let's stand. We'll close in a word of prayer.